Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and joining me in the Money Cafe today is Emma Hurd, EY's Oceania Partner of Climate Change and Sustainability Services. Emma, welcome to the Money Cafe.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Now, I thought that, now that we're going to clearly, or the government is going to obviously announce a target of net zero by 2050 fairly soon, once it sort of corrals the National Party cats, things are starting to move, and there's the big conference in Glasgow coming up in a month's time. I thought it'd be a good idea to get you on to talk about what's happening and what everyone can expect. So I thought a good way to start might be, Emma, to talk about your background in this area, which is quite extensive. Just tell us a bit. You're currently at EY, obviously a partner there, and you've been there a few months, in fact. But prior to that, or you started, you've had a long career in this area of climate change, and starting with Westpac, where you're a director of emissions and environment. Tell us about what you've been doing.
Yeah, I think to some extent, I often joke about the fact that if you read through my CV, it's a little bit like a walk through roughly 20 years of development of climate and finance and policy and strategy in Australia, because not just the job titles, but even in terms of the direction of travel, how we've seen this area evolve as a risk and an opportunity, particularly for business, but also just in terms of the level of kind of focus that the finance sector has increasingly brought to these issues as well. So to answer the question, so I actually started originally in Westpac in government relations and social responsibility, as it was called back in 2001. And that kind of quickly evolved into, you know, corporate responsibility and sustainability type role, which focused on the development of the bank's early sustainability reporting and also environmental management system and its climate change position. And then around 2007, moved into the institutional bank specifically to look at the commercial response to climate change issues, which, if you recall, was pretty much almost exactly the same time that Prime Minister Rudd was elected, Australia signed up to Kyoto, and we began our journey for the introduction of emissions trading. So for about 5 years, I rode that roller coaster in terms of developing out the bank's clean tech investment strategy, its carbon risk strategy, its products and services for customers, and the establishment of its emissions trading desk, and then wound up the emissions trading desk around the mid-2010s. And then the last couple of years I was there actually was focused on the introduction of ESG risk management frameworks. And then after Westpac, I actually moved on to another role as the head of the investor group on climate change, which was the institutional investors, and spent 6 years working with the investor community as they significantly ramped up their pressure on companies to have a response to these issues. So kind of all different parts of the market, but kind of followed the agenda as it's evolved in Australia.
And that investor group on climate change has turned out to be quite influential, hasn't it? I mean, they've been pushing companies increasingly into, announcing themselves, companies announcing net zero by 2050 targets for themselves, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, I mean, like the Investor Group on Climate Change, or IGCC for short, really it was about working with Oz and NZ investors around what do you do about climate change? So how do you understand it as a risk in your portfolio? How do you begin to integrate it into your strategic asset allocation strategies? Where should you be, trying to increase your investment and exposure to emerging climate solutions? And then also, how should you be looking to reduce your exposure to carbon-intensive, high-risk companies in particular? And then lastly, as you mentioned, how should you be integrating it into your corporate engagement strategies? Like, so what should you be asking companies that you're a major shareholder in to do? And a lot of that has been, well, what do we want you to do? We want you to set a goal for net zero by 2050 and show us how you're going to deliver it.
And how do the companies have to deliver it? I mean, is it simply a matter of buying offsets and buying carbon credit units?
I think that's not the most value-adding response, and I think the market would share that view, and not just because it would end up costing a fortune for some companies, but also it's fundamentally about three things. It's about showing that you have the internal governance processes in place and the capabilities at the board level and the executive level to really deeply understand the structural change that's going on in your industry sector. So whether it's gas, whether it's Woolies, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's ICT, you know, for every different industry sector, they have a different set of challenges. So do you have the right governance? And then if you've got the governance, what's your strategy? So how are you going to evolve your business, invest in new opportunities? How are you linking up your CapEx and OpEx allocations to delivery on those goals? And how are you actually repositioning, you know, in some cases, your portfolio of assets to evolve substantially from what you look like today? And then thirdly, it's really about looking for transparency and disclosure. And, you know, before net zero, there was TCFD, or rather with net zero, there is TCFD, the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. The accounting standard launched at the same time as the Paris Agreement was finalised.
This is the thing that's headed by the former Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, right?
That's absolutely right. And never did we think that an accounting standard would save the world, but definitely it's proven to be one of the most influential tools in the toolbox. And investors are really looking for companies. And increasingly, governments are mandating disclosure against this framework to better understand climate risks and opportunities as well. So governance, strategy and disclosure is what investors are asking for.
So most of what we read about, you know, in the press and everything is to do with government policy, in particular in Australia, and the arguments that are going on here and so on. But really, I think we're kind of missing, it seems to me, and one of the reasons I wanted to get you onto the Money Cafe is one of the things we're kind of missing what's going on in the private sector and also around the world. So give us a rundown of, I mean, how many companies are you aware of that have announced a target or have targeted or committed to net zero by 2050? And give us a bit of a sense of what's going on in the private sector.
Yeah, well, probably the best example I can give you is to show the momentum and the scale of change that we're seeing here in Australia, but also globally, is an initiative called Climate Action 100 Plus. So this was actually launched December 2017 at the President Macron's One Planet Summit with five different regional investor groups.
When was that?
December 2017.
Yep.
And really kind of focused on, you know, who are the companies who are in everyone's portfolio who are the biggest greenhouse gas emitters in the world? And how do we bring together investors to collectively engage with these companies to move the dial, so to speak, in terms of the system-wide emissions that are there that everyone's facing a risk exposure to? So Climate Action 100 launches. Today, it's got over 600 global investors participating with over 70 trillion Aus kind of funds under management behind it. So almost a third of all managed funds in the world now participating in a voluntary initiative. And it's engaging with 167 companies globally who are all MSCI ACWI listed. So they're the companies likely to be in everyone's portfolios, who are identified as the most systemically significant greenhouse gas emitting companies in the world. So from Australia's perspective, there's 15 companies on there. That includes, the obvious AGL, Origin, Santos. It also includes Qantas. It includes a whole range of different companies, you know, Boral, Adelaide Brighton, you know, indicative companies from industry sectors that are, you know, significant in the context of their market and their emissions profile. So since this initiative has launched, 111 of those 167 companies now have net zero commitments in place by 2050. If all of those companies achieve their emission reduction goals, it's an equivalent emission reduction roughly the size of China and China's emissions. So that's the kind of scale. In that one initiative, you can see the kind of scale of the changes that we're seeing on a market perspective. In terms of the shift towards net zero. In Australia, I guess a couple of other observations. In Australia, it's fairly well known. Every major state and territory net zero, increasingly ramping up their 2030 targets, which is also really important. More than 80% of Australia's trade now goes to countries that have net zero commitments in place, countries like China, Japan, South Korea, for example. And we also know that almost half of the ASX have now got ASX 100 have also got net zero commitments in place. So this understanding that net zero is where we need to get to, and we need to work out how we're going to get there and how much it's going to cost, is increasingly kind of becoming quite the norm in the real world, or in the global economy, even while it still seems to be so hard to reconcile in the political economy.
So what are those 111 companies doing? I mean, someone like Qantas, they have to fly planes, right? How are they going to get to net zero?
Yeah, well, I mean, Qantas's emissions profile has obviously dropped significantly in the last 2 years, but that's probably not the way that you want to achieve it. But I think a lot of the strategies involve a kind of mix of core components. I mean, one, you have to look at the technology shifts which deliver emission reductions in your systems and processes. Two, you have to look at innovation and, you know, where are the kind of breakthrough or disruptive technologies that will substantively change the emissions profile of the way you do things. Energy, if you decarbonize electricity supply, you achieve quite a significant component of emissions reductions. And that can be done either through power purchasing agreements or it can be done via on-site renewable energy generation. We're seeing some quite interesting different approaches there. And then lastly, for residual emissions, you may there's also working with your customer chain and your value chain to reduce emissions in a partnership model, which is increasingly becoming popular in big manufacturing industries, for example, such as steel. And then lastly, you offset the residual emissions and until you can work out how to do that last part. Even in the context of Australia, where technically we don't have a national emissions trading scheme, we have a national emissions trading scheme because so many companies are voluntarily seeking to put in place supply chains around their own offsets to meet their own broader net zero commitments.
In fact, the spot price of Australian carbon credit units, which are auctioned every few months by the Clean Energy Regulator, has shot up to $26 a tonne recently.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a bit of demand.
Yeah, absolutely. And and there's a secondary trading market as well, I might add. So, we're also kind of seeing with both ACCUs but also with a lot of the other voluntary credits, this increasing demand for them and real concerns across the market around supply. So are we investing enough in generating the supply of offset credits? And this is actually an area where there is quite a lot of opportunity in Australia for a couple of reasons. One, because we've got the institutional frameworks which support the verification certification of credits. And secondly, we've got the landmass to and the capability at a country level to really ramp up our offset capacity. So, you know, a lot of the international companies are also looking to Australia as a source of offset supply as well, if we can just get our ducks lined up properly.
So given what all the emitters are doing, the big emitters are doing in voluntarily, as you've been describing, what does it really matter what the government does? Is it simply a matter of ensuring there are no freeloaders, you know, that everybody's basically in the same boat, we're not just relying on a few companies that voluntarily do it and others just kind of coast along without doing it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think, you know, absolutely it matters what the government does, because if you're talking about whole of economy change in every industry sector and at every level of the economy, the government absolutely has a crucial role to play in managing the transition. And by that I mean, this is the importance of providing market confidence by setting, you know, robust targets. So this is why we have this obsession with both 2050 and 2030 targets. Like, how fast are we making this change? What's the sort of timeline and the glide path for this change? It's also a question of there are certain regulatory interventions that are required on a market basis or to incentivize the accelerated growth of new technologies. And if you think about the importance of the role of government, you only have to look at Australia's current EV deployment figures to see that government has a major role to play there in terms of facilitating the market deployment of new technologies. But also you can just look at what's happened with the energy market to see that the influence that government can have in both a constructive and destructive way through regulatory and policy shifts. And the implications that that's had for a lot of energy companies who are trying to manage their way through a very messy transition as well. So on a whole range of different fronts, the government has a crucial role to play in making sure that the transition that is going to happen happens in a way which, you know, sets Australia up to be really competitive in a globally decarbonising economy, rather than being dragged along, you know, by the scruff of the neck and sort of being pushed or pulled into a transition which is going to get pretty messy, and particularly pretty messy for a lot of people working in communities that are in carbon intensive industries.
So what sort of policies do you think the government needs to announce to back up any target of net zero by 2050? I mean, obviously they can just say we're going to have a target of net zero by 2050, but what else do you think they need to do to sort of support that target?
Well, it really translates to net zero by 2050, absolutely, but it's also the 2030 target. So 2030 is the time frame and to which these sorts of commitments align with the investment cycle and the capex or the operational cycle of most businesses as well. So how is this? Are we going to do everything in 2049, or are we actually going to try and manage it on a step change basis from now in terms of the change we're going to see in the economy? So there's that kind of, you know, bringing forward those targets to have a clearer view of what that's going to look like. It's also a question of facilitating the growth of the offset market. So at the moment we have just one buyer, one of the main buyers in the market, which is the government, but actually beginning to think through, you know, how do we use that as a mechanism for allowing companies to manage their carbon exposure and to have access to more market-based solutions. So, you know, obviously the most efficient way to do that is to have a national consistent price on carbon. But given the problematic aspects of that, even if we were to evolve the safeguard mechanism into more of a baseline and credit system, I think that would go a long way to assisting with some of these shortfall issues. There's a number of industry sector specific policies and interventions that we kind of need to help facilitate and pull through technology change. So whether that's in transport, you know, whether it's resolving what do we do when the REC comes off, how do we begin to put in place interventions in the energy market to facilitate more rapid change? How do we think about impacts for communities from an adjustment perspective? But even in terms of manufacturing, are there steps that can be taken to facilitate infrastructure change to support the more rapid deployment of on-site renewables, for example? A lot of this is kind of both the micro and the macro. So do we get the macro settings right in terms of the signals and the price support and the market support? And then do we have the industry sector thinking and planning and kind of bringing together the major players to talk about how are we going to make this happen in a way that isn't just survival of the last company standing? I think that's the important role that government has to play.
But so far the government's been talking about how it's all going to be handled by technology. And obviously they're trying to avoid putting a price on carbon by saying that. Is that right? I mean, you think that it's going to be possible to do it with technology at all?
Well, technology is a crucial part of it, right? But then the question with technology is who pays, who benefits, who's the loser in the transition? How do we actually, you know, unlock investment into these technological shifts, and what's the enabling infrastructure to actually make it happen? Like, it's one thing to just sort of say, you know, we're going to be a global world leader in hydrogen, but then you actually have to put in place the support systems and processes to facilitate that. And it's true with every other technological shift. You know, we didn't end up with 25% renewables in the energy market by accident. We did it through regulatory and policy intervention that facilitated the technology pull through and provided a financing mechanism for it as well. So, you know, it's a question. The technology and the technology roadmap itself is entirely appropriate that Australia should have that, but it's not the only thing we should have. It actually needs to be wrapped up in a broader set of, coherent policies that actually show how all of the different levers are working together.
Do you think we can have a coal industry by when? Or, let me put it another way. When do you think the coal industry has to close down, by 2030 or 2050?
Yeah, well, that's the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? You know, it's interesting to look at the I think it's incredibly hard to put a date on it because it depends how you're answering it, right? I mean, if you're answering it from a pure environmental perspective, you would say 2030. But if you're answering it from a when is it likely to close from an economic perspective, then it's a bit more variable. In terms of where those demand factors are and price points and a whole range of different factors as well.
But there can't be a coal industry, can there?
Well, increasingly what we're seeing is global recognition that thermal coal, to be specific, thermal coal, has an extremely limited role to play in a decarbonizing global economy. And, you know, but this faces some interesting challenges, though, because you've got these competing pressures. Like, on the one hand, there's this kind of recognition that with national commitments, with changing for finance and investor appetite for the sector, the likelihood of ongoing continuation of the sector is shrinking almost day by day, announcement by announcement. Now, on the other hand, the price points and the market demand for it currently is this kind of countervailing pressure. So it also becomes this question around how that demand for it shrinks over time, and then who's going to be the last country, the last company, and the last investor holding on to coal. So, I it's a very contested area, but I think the direction of travel is pretty clear in terms of the shrinking demand for
the last coal mine standing.
Yeah.
That's interesting, yeah.
And it also goes this question around this is the funny thing about markets, right, and about investment and business decisions, right? Sometimes you can look at a set of numbers and you can say, well, the obvious outcome of these numbers is decision X, but that's not what we're going to do. We're going to do decision Y. And, you know, increasingly what we're seeing is that, you know, numbers would argue for the continuation of thermal coal for a number of years still to come. But the market is deciding, we just don't think thermal coal is going to continue beyond a certain date. When that date is, different views, but definitely the market is kind of saying, we're going to go with decision Y. We actually think that in the long run, this is a structural shift. This is going to roll out of the energy system.
Yeah, right. Now, Emma, we actually have some questions for you from our listeners.
Okay.
So let's get into it. And this one's from your namesake, Emma. What's the difference between climate change and global warming? Is there a difference?
No, there's no difference. It's just the weaponized semantics of the climate change debate.
Yeah, it's just a different way of putting it, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because when it first began, people thought that climate change was a less threatening way of describing global warming, and then a lot of people decided actually we needed to have a more challenging way of describing it, so they went back to global warming. And in fact, actually now a lot of people call it global heating or the climate crisis, because trying to convey a sense of urgency around the issue. But ultimately, it's the same thing.
Here's one from Valeria who says, I haven't quite understood it. How and why banks and tech companies have to become green or will lose their investment? What do they have to do with causing or preventing climate change?
Well, the banks are an interesting one, because they have an interesting position in thinking around economic development. So, I mean, if you think about it, so I was at Westpac, right? And so Westpac was older than Federation. So it was formed by an act of the New South Wales Parliament before Australia existed as a federation. It had been through every major economic shift in the Australian economy and the global economy. It had a few hairy moments on the way through. But the conclusion it had come to is that it needed to simultaneously have a whole of economy view, as in what's going on across all industry sectors and all levels of the economy, from borrowing money for a car to borrowing money for a huge energy generator, to actually being able to look ahead and think through how the economy was evolving as well. So, you know, if you think about banks and debt, they're always rolling forward in terms of their appetite, in terms of their risk pricing, in terms of how they're thinking around industry impacts for companies and its ability to or likelihood of impacting returns or return on capital or the ability to pay back debt. So having awareness of where the world is going is pretty important in terms of understanding risk. So a lot of banks have been thinking about this in the context of, well, this is a trend which is beginning to bite on the returns, on the balance sheets of companies, but also it's one where we think it will get worse for some industry sectors and it'll get better for others, and we need to have a deep understanding of the issues. So where money is going, what it's financing, what it's contributing to has become a kind of increasing area of scrutiny for both credit risk officers and for bank customers, as in where's my deposit going on the other side. For tech companies, it's all about the solutions. So what's their role in terms of digital disruption in energy supply, for example? So it's actually quite a substantial opportunity for them in terms of it being a technology play. But for every single company, one of the big, you know, common threads was energy prices and energy related to emissions, particularly in Australia where our electricity supply is so carbon intensive. So everybody's been focused on energy, and that's kind of driven through this wider understanding of some of the shifts required. But I don't think anyone's exempt from this issue. So banks, IT companies, just as involved as supermarkets, as coal companies.
Everyone has a role to play.
Everyone has a role to play.
Carlos says, I don't understand the whole carbon emission credit issue and how these things work. It seems really complicated. Are you, Emma, are you able to explain clearly, quickly, or simply what that, how that works?
I'll settle back. I'll try and do it quickly. But I think there's a difference between, you know, credits and offsets. And I think this is where it sometimes gets a bit confusing. So offsets is where effectively you're trying to neutralize the emissions that you're producing. So you want to have a net zero impact as a result of your economic activities. So you, for every ton of greenhouse gas emissions that you produce, you buy a ton removed somewhere else. So you end up with a net zero position. And it's in, it also functions. So there's that environmental impact. It's not reducing the footprint, but it's just neutralizing the footprint. It's also frequently used as an internal price signal. So if you have to pay for an offset for every ton of carbon you produce, then you use that in your internal business case to make different kinds of decisions around investing in actual emission reductions. So it provides a price signal for reducing your emissions rather than paying for offsets as well. And then in a number of compliance markets, such as in the EU, you also have obligations for management of your emissions under compliance-based schemes where you have to either get below a baseline or you have to account or acquit units for every ton that you produce. So there's different market schemes that apply, but a compliance unit versus an offset unit are probably the main differentiation. And when it all boils down to it, it's all about paying for the emissions that you produce and using that price point to change your actual underlying emissions profile. It's probably
right, okay.
I think I have to explain it without getting into the whole world of the different.
No, that's right. I think that'll do us. But how big a problem, Aaron says, how big a problem is methane from cows? And does the world's addiction to hamburgers mean that that's going to be very difficult to shift?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a good question. Well, interestingly enough, the meat and livestock sector is already responding to these issues in a lot of ways. So the meat and livestock, the MLA, the Meat and Livestock Association of Australia, also has a commitment to go net zero, I might add. So it's not just the heavy industry companies, it's also the ag.
How are they going to do that?
Well, they're not quite sure either. But, I mean, beef is two things. One, it's the cows themselves, but it's also land use. So the management of land is also a factor which contributes to the emissions profile of beef products. There are some really interesting innovations occurring I hesitate to use the word technology when it comes to animal livestock. It sounds a bit weird, but in terms of dietary supplements which reduce the methane produced by cows, and particularly there's some interesting work going on in Australia around seaweed-based dietary supplements which change the emissions profile of a cow, how much methane it produces, which is quite interesting. But I think that the meat and livestock industry has a bigger issue, which is an increasing portion of the consumer market don't want to eat meat at all. So appetite for hamburgers is a bigger existential issue than just the emissions of the animals. It's also all tied up with dietary and well-being considerations and also animal welfare considerations as well. So, yeah, it's quite a challenging landscape.
And finally, Greg says, isn't what you call climate change just the natural evolution of the Earth?
Yes and no. So the climate has changed over millennia, but it was always something that caused it to change. So seas have risen, seas have fallen. We've had ice ages and warmer periods. This is all true. That's how we know. That's how we can understand what's actually happening around us. But the major events which caused it in the past were things like, you know, the meteor that landed and took out the dinosaurs or, extreme volcanic activity releasing emissions into the atmosphere. What's causing it now is us. So we are humans are the major event which is causing climate change to happen. So it's not a question of the fact that it never happened before, it did, but it's what the causal factor here is. And it's basically it's 9 billion people industrializing and being incredibly inefficient in the way that we've done that, which is causing the major event, which is changing the climate. So, yes, it's always happened. Yes, it's part of the natural system. But on this particular occasion, we are the ones who are cooking the system.
Well, Emma, it's been great. Thank you. I thought it'd be interesting and I was not wrong. So I really appreciate you joining us today on the Money Cafe. Thanks very much.
No worries. Great to be here.
And thanks to you for listening to today's episode of the Money Cafe. I hope you enjoyed it, and send in questions for next week and we'll answer them next Thursday. Until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and I've been talking to Emma Hurd, who is EY's partner in charge of what do you call yourself, Emma?
Climate change and sustainability.
There you are. EY's partner of climate change and sustainability, Emma Hurd. Thanks a lot.